You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
Glad you're with us. My name is Will. I'm one of the pastors here. It is a great Sunday to worship the risen Christ. That said, it has been a really odd week for me personally. Physically, not felt very well. Been kind of up and down emotionally. Been wrestling with some big decisions, questions I've got going on in my mind. It's been a weird week. None of that is super unusual. You've probably had some of those things this week too. So I guess what makes it unusual for me, you know, I'm a pastor, is that it's Easter. Like, this is Easter. We have electric guitars, I'm wearing a tie. This is the day where we celebrate the most incredible event in the history of the world, the resurrection of Jesus. Of course, we celebrate that every Sunday, but Easter week brings with it a heightened sense of anticipation and joy. Nevertheless, on Wednesday, when I sat down to work on this sermon, I lasted about 3 minutes and ended up listening to another sermon that I had found online. And the title of that sermon was called Pastors and Depression. Listen to the whole thing. In the sermon, he gave 9 markers of depression, and I'm taking notes like I'm going through it. And he says, if you have 7 of these, well, you know, you're depressed. So good news, I didn't make the cut. I didn't have 7 of the markers. I didn't have 7 of them. Which in its own way was kind of discouraging. It's weird how failing a depression test still leaves you feeling a little bit like a failure, you know? All that to say, I've been a little down, and this sermon's starting to get some of you down. So let me get to the point. The point is this. As I tried to sort through my thoughts and my emotions this week, I kept asking God this question. And the question was, how does the resurrection help me right now? More than once, I woke up in the middle of the night, and that was the question right on the front of my mind. God, how does the resurrection help me right now? It's just a different version of the classic question, where are you, God? So when you ask God a question, you don't just sit back and wait for lightning bolts. You go looking for answers. The primary place you go is in his word. These are the words of God, and he speaks to us through them. And so I went there. I read all of the resurrection accounts this week from Matthew and Mark and Luke and John, read them multiple times, reflected on them. And as I did, I was surprisingly comforted by them. It turns out my mood this week is very fitting for the mood of that first Easter morning. When you just look at the landscape, the emotional landscape of the disciples and the women who are with them and then the others outside the 12 disciples, the key words that pop up in all of the accounts are they're afraid, they're perplexed, they've lost hope, they've lost their sense of ambition, they don't know what to do with their life now. They're confused. So much of our discouragement and our confusion has to do with just sort of getting locked in on our lives, right? My problems, my perspective, my limited resources, my unfulfilled dreams, just my life. And you see that in the resurrection accounts. Everybody who encounters Jesus, the risen Christ, doesn't recognize him. Like, they don't know it's him. I'll give it to you. He has a new body. He has a resurrected body, and it would look different, but it wouldn't look so different that you wouldn't know it's him. He still has the scars in his hands and his feet. His body isn't the reason they don't see him. The reason they don't see Jesus is because they're looking at themselves still. In the thickest of dramatic ironies, they're asking the question, "Where are you, God?" And he's right there with them. They just don't see. The Easter story is about people coming to see Jesus. It unfolds in stages, but they do eventually see him. At the very end of Luke 24, there's this wonderful little line where it says, after Jesus says, touch and see me, it says, and while they were still disbelieving for joy and marveling, Jesus said to them. And this phrase, disbelieving for joy, is kind of like when we would say, Like when we believe something is true, but it's just so good, we can't believe it. It's like, it's too good to be true. That's what's going on there. And so throughout the whole story, their problem is that they're slow to believe and that the doubts arise in their hearts. They have a hard time believing because things are so bad. But at the end of the story, they can't believe it because things are so good. And all that's changed is just what they see. And so how do we get there? How do we get to the place of disbelieving for joy? Especially if you're starting in a place of discouragement and doubt. That's the point of Easter. It's to come to see Jesus in the midst of whatever you're going through, risen and exalted, absolutely, but also with you in the midst of your life, and to be giddy about it. Well, as I said, it unfolds in stages for them. The first thing that they have to learn and that we have to learn is that resurrection means this. It means things are not what they seem. And specifically, we'll see with them and for our own lives that our circumstances are not what they seem. We are not what we seem. And perhaps Jesus is not what you thought he was either. Let's look at circumstances. If you've ever been in the place where you were asking the question, God, where are you? Now, you will not have much trouble putting yourself in this scene in Luke 24. Open up to Luke 24, stay there. I'm not going to go through every verse, all right? Rest easy. I am going to jump around a little bit. So if you have it open, you can keep up. But just notice the mood starting in verse 1. On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took spices that they had prepared and went to the tomb. And the reason they're taking spices to the tomb is because they're going to prepare Jesus' body for burial. Just want you to see that their assumption and everyone's assumption is that Jesus of Nazareth is dead. They don't have a category for anything else. And so they're doing what they're supposed to do. They're going to the tomb to prepare his body. Verse 2, they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. But when they entered, they didn't find the body of the Lord Jesus. And while they were wondering about this, and that word wondering means to be perplexed. It means to not know which way to go. It means to be without resources or even to be embarrassed or to have doubt. That's the women. Jump down to verse 11. After the women go tell the disciples what's going on, Peter got up and ran to the tomb. Verse 12, and bending over, he saw the strips of linen lying by themselves, and he went away wondering to himself what had happened. And then Luke cuts scene from Peter at the tomb and switches over to another place. And so with the image of Peter kind of scratching his head, we now find ourselves on the road to Emmaus with two other disciples of Jesus. Verse 13, let's start there. Now that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus. Now these two disciples had been in Jerusalem. They had seen everything that had happened. They had been with the 12 disciples. These are insiders. They're followers of Jesus. And now, because of all that's happened, they're making the 7-mile walk home. Because where else are you going to go? Like, it's over. He's dead. This is a walk of defeat going home. Verse 14, they were talking with each other about everything that had happened, trying to sort it out, debating, talking and discussing these things with each other. And when they were, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. He asked them, "What are you discussing as you walk along?" And they stood still. They stopped in their tracks, their faces downcast. Later in the last scene, verse 36, as the disciples were talking about these things, Jesus himself stood among them and said to them, "Peace to you." But they were startled and frightened and thought they saw a spirit or a ghost. And he said to them, "Why are you troubled? Why are doubts arising in your hearts?" So the first note of the resurrection story is confusion. These are downcast, disillusioned, maybe depressed people. They're all asking the question, "God, where are you?" And I find that very comforting because it means that things aren't what they seem. They think it's over. They think Jesus is dead, gone forever, but things are not what they see. Now, why don't they see things as they really are? Why don't they see Jesus? And I want to suggest to you that it's because I think they're still locked in on their circumstances. They think their circumstances tell the whole story. Listen, the circumstances of your life don't tell the story of your life. Your failures, your struggles, your weaknesses, those things are real, but they don't tell the whole story of your life. Incidentally, neither do your accomplishments or your accolades or the approval you get from people. Those don't tell the whole story of your life. In Colossians 3, Paul says, your life is hidden with Christ in God. And when Christ, who is your life, appears, you will appear with him in glory. You see what he's saying? Your circumstances are not your life. Christ is your life. And the Easter story is about people coming to see and take hold of that resurrection reality, that Christ is our life. Let's go back to the conversation on the road to Emmaus. Jesus is joined the two disciples, the downcast disciples. He comes alongside them. He asks them what they're talking about. And they can't recognize him. They don't know it's him. And they're even more shocked that anybody would be asking this question, because they're like, wait, have you not heard? Are you not from here? They can't imagine anyone not knowing what has taken place over the last few days. And so they begin to explain to Jesus what had happened to Jesus and who Jesus was. Verse 19. This is what they say. He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. So in short, they're explaining how bad their circumstances are. And when you're reading this, you sort of have to ask the question, why is Jesus even having this conversation? Why is he letting them go on like this? It's got to be embarrassing for them in the end. Well, I think he's letting them do that because he wants them to go deeper. To see things as they really are, you've got to get below the surface of how things seem. Confusion and discouragement is really not about what's happening to us. Deeper than that, it's about what we hoped would happen. Just think about something in your life that you're discouraged about lately. Just go deeper into that just for a second. And tell me if there isn't some unfulfilled longing down there, something you hoped would happen. God wants you to dig deeper into that so that you can transfer that hope to him. That's why Jesus is having this conversation. That's why he's so merciful and so patient and so long-suffering with us. He wants them to get to the bottom of this unfulfilled hope. And that's what happens. Verse 20, after they explain the circumstances, he was handed over to death. He was crucified. Verse 21, but we had hoped that he would be the one to redeem Israel. This is what's happening to us. But underneath it, what we hoped would happen is that he would be the one to redeem Israel. They had hoped he would redeem Israel by conquering the Romans and rising to power. They wanted that so bad that they couldn't see what was actually happening, that Jesus was redeeming Israel, not from suffering, but through suffering. Only when they see that do they see Jesus, and when they do, it changes their whole demeanor. For every character in the story, when they really come to see Jesus, it changes everything. They are energized by it. Notice everybody's running around all of a sudden. So the women run back to the disciples, and Peter, when he hears it, runs to the tomb. The two disciples who had just made the 7-mile walk of defeat home, when they see Jesus, it says, at once they got up and went back to the disciples, 7 miles back. There is this renewed energy and purpose and ambition in these people. Why? Because Jesus is alive. Things aren't what they seem. He's not gone. He's right here with us. He didn't conquer the Romans. It's better than that. He conquered Satan and sin and death. He's not the Savior we thought he was. He's so much better. There are some people in this room that when I say this phrase, they'll know everything else I'm going to say after it. 4th and 5. Some of you know. Some of you know. 4th and 5 was the situation for Texas in the 2006 Rose Bowl against USC with like 20-something seconds left on the clock. We're down. It's 4th and 5. We got one hope. His name is VY. Before that, of course, leading up to the game, this was a big game. It was Texas and it was USC. And the bigger part of that was USC. ESPN had actually done a whole segment the whole week before. Every day they were comparing USC to all the great teams in college football history. Because the question was, could this be the greatest college football team in history? So every day they would compare them to like all the great teams. There was no such segment for UT. They were good, but nobody thought of them as the greatest ever. But USC was possibly the greatest ever. The game was in their backyard. It was at the Rose Bowl. They had the Heisman Trophy winner. All the buzz was about USC. But the game was close until it wasn't. With 6:42 left in the fourth quarter, and I didn't even have to look that up. I just know that. USC scored. I think it was Jarrett, number 19. I have this image in my head. He catches. He goes across the goal line. They go up 38-26 with 6 minutes left. And then our two players on that play collided, and they're both laying on the ground. I think one of them broke his leg on that play. It was the absolute low point of the Rose Bowl. It's like, we're down by 12. Our guys are laying on the ground. Somebody's injured. This is it. We're done. It was the moment that our hopes and dreams faded. And they were spanning the audience, and they would cut to some UT fans, and you could see it on their faces too, downcast is what they were. Then they would cut to USC fans, and they'd be cheering and jumping around and going nuts because like they knew they had it at that point. Now, of course, those of you who knew what 4th and 5 was know that the story didn't go that way. VY did save us. We came back, and we won. It's fun to talk about now. It wasn't fun at 6:42. I go back and watch that game more than I should, probably. And you know where I like to start? I watched it this morning. You know where I like to start it? I like to start it at 6:42. I like to start it at what was really the low point, because it's not a low point anymore. It's the moment where everybody thinks we're going to lose, but I know the whole story. We're going to win, and it's going to be glorious. Some of you feel like you're at the 6:42 mark in your life. The resurrection means that things are not as they seem. We're going to win, and it's going to be glorious. It's more than just our circumstances. The Easter story tells us that we're not what we seem either. On that first Easter morning, they were trying to understand who Jesus was, for sure, but I think they were also trying to understand who they were. Think about the identity crisis that they must have been going through. For 3 years, they had given everything to Jesus, gone all in with him. They left family and friends and hometowns and secure jobs, everything. And now they have nothing to show for it. That's like the worst feeling ever, to feel like you have nothing to show for your life. In their world and in ours, life was about what you did, what you accomplished, what you had. It was about the resume. They had hoped that these 3 years with Jesus would sort of boost their resume, would get them a place at the table when he came into power. And it's explicitly written this way, like just a week or so before, when they're coming into Jerusalem, James and John, two of the disciples, come up to Jesus. They're walking along and they say to him, hey, we're going to ask you a question, but before we ask you the question, we want you to say yes. Like 5-year-olds do that kind of stuff. This is how blind they are by their power lust. And Jesus is like, no, it doesn't work that way. What is it you want? And then they say, it's unbelievable. They say, well, we want, when you come into power, to sit on your right and your left. We want to be vice presidents. And Jesus is just like, guys, it does not work that way. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life away as a ransom for many. I don't know if you watch the Shark Tank. And the Shark Tank is just entrepreneurs come before investors. They make their pitch, their product, their service, their business, whatever it is. And if the investors like it, they invest money. And if they don't, they don't. But sometimes it goes further than that. Sometimes the entrepreneur's thing is just terrible. Like, they should stop this. But you don't want to say that. You don't want to be mean. But there is one shark who feels like it's his duty to let people know that. And so if somebody comes in and their pitch isn't good or their product isn't good, he tells them before they leave. He's like, hey, you need to stop doing this. And you need to do something else. This is a hobby. It's not a business. And he kind of makes, I mean, it's brutal the way he does it. Now, I've seen, I think, almost every episode of this show. And in the they always do like this exit interview of the entrepreneur when they're going back out. And on the times where he just lays into him and says, you should stop doing this. This is not for you. Not once have I ever seen in an exit interview the entrepreneur go, you know, I'm really going to take that to heart. I think he might be right. Maybe I'm not what I thought I was. Maybe I should stop. Never. They never say that. You know what they say? They say, they're going to regret this. I'm going to show them I've got what it takes. That's kind of like the disciples. Peter, especially. Peter always wants to be first in line to show Jesus that he's got what it takes. But the last few days for Peter before the death of Jesus were just a total meltdown. The Last Supper, Jesus is washing all the disciples' feet, and he comes to Peter, and Peter's like, no, not my feet. Right? Nobody else says this, just Peter. He means good by it. He means, like, I should be washing your feet, but he still, like, assumes that he knows better than Jesus. At that same meal, Jesus says, one of you is going to betray me. Peter gets up and says, whoa, whoa, whoa. And he looks around at all his friends, and he's like, look, these guys, maybe. I could see. Maybe these guys will fall away, but I will never fall away. And Jesus goes, yes, you will. Like tonight, 3 times, you're going to deny me. Peter's like, nope. When Jesus gets arrested, Peter pulls out a sword, which is just ridiculous on so many accounts because nobody else is pulling out a sword. And beyond that, he's not very good with the sword. He goes to strike this guy and he just like nips his ear. It's embarrassing. When Jesus is on trial, Peter's out in the courtyard, and this little girl says, don't you know Jesus? And he's like, oh, no, I don't. And she keeps asking him, and he curses Jesus. He says, I know nothing about this man. Peter was not what he thought he was. He didn't show them. That's what they all had to discover. That's what we have to discover. We're not what we think we are. We're worse and better. Let me explain what I mean. We're worse in this way. It's one thing to see that Jesus was delivering Israel not from suffering, but through suffering. It's another thing to see why he did it that way. When he explains this, he emphasizes that it had to be this way. Verse 25, he's telling the men on the road, he said to them, foolish ones, slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? So Jesus says that his suffering and his death was necessary. Like if he just wanted to do things that way, then that would say something about God and his ways. But if it had to be this way, if he had to suffer and die, then that says something about us. It says we don't just need to be delivered from the Romans or whatever our circumstances are. We've got bigger problems than that. Bigger problems than what's going on around us. We've got a problem inside of us. When Peter tells Jesus, no, you're not washing my feet, Jesus is like, no, I need to wash your feet. And Peter's like, okay, well then let's do the whole body wash. She's like, no, that's not what he's talking about. Peter doesn't get it. He can't clean himself because that's not the kind of uncleanness Jesus is getting at. Jesus is saying, you're unclean on the inside. We're unclean on the inside, and our only hope of being cleansed is to be washed by the blood of Jesus. That's why he had to suffer and die. Jesus' work on the cross is so total and so final. I want you to know that. Yes, we are worse than we thought, but salvation is complete. His washing is thorough. And so when he raises from the dead, he's not coming for them to scold them. He's not looking for Peter to be like, I told you so. 3 times, man. Not at all. He comes at them with mercy and grace and compassion. In all the other resurrection accounts, when the women see that it's Jesus outside the tomb, he says to them, hey, go back and tell the disciples and Peter to meet me in Galilee. He names them. Why does he do that? I got to think that if he didn't do that, if the women went back to the disciples and said, hey, Jesus is alive, he wants you to go meet him in Galilee like he told you to, I think Peter would be sitting there going, me too? I mean, did you see what happened over the last 3 days? And so he names him Peter. So he knows. Such mercy. Such humility on the part of Jesus. Listen, our acceptance before God is not based on anything that we've done or haven't done. Our acceptance before God is based on what Christ has done. His life, his death, his resurrection in our place. This is how the New Testament talks about Christians. It says that we have died with him and been raised with him so that we might walk in newness of life with him. Dying to Christ just simply means dying to the things that used to run and define your world. It means dying to the resume. That's not how we live anymore. And being raised with Christ means taking up new life under his gracious rule. The old has gone and the new has come. And the resurrection gives us power to live in that new life. Like at work, no longer are you using people to gain power. The resurrection means you have power so that you might give yourself for the good of people. In your relationships, no longer are you pretending and performing and trying to get people's acceptance and feeling insecure if you don't. In the resurrection, you have this peace with God. You rest in the acceptance that you have before him, and it frees you to genuinely be interested in people, to know them and be known by them. In your hardships, Christ is there with you. He's reminding you of his words. He said, in this world, you're going to have trouble, but take heart. I have overcome the world. And the old way of anxiety and fear is gone, and the new way of endurance and patience with joy has come. Right now, Jesus is present with us, making our worship acceptable to God, ministering to us by his Spirit, opening our minds to understand the scriptures. The old way of just going to church because you're supposed to, especially on Easter, that is gone. The new way of worship in spirit and in truth has come. If you have been raised with Christ, there's more to you than meets the eye. You're not what you thought you were. You're so much better because of Christ. As the resurrection story unfolds, they see that their circumstances are not what they seem. God's up to something much bigger than they could have ever conceived. They see that they are not what they seem. Salvation is much deeper than they thought it would be. And as they see those two things, they begin to see Jesus, which is what they were looking for all along. The resurrection is historical. It happened. And there's a mountain of evidence for that. But if we're honest, we want it to be more than just history. The resurrection is theological. I mean, it contains the essence of who God is and what he's doing in our world. But if we're honest, we want it to be more than theology. If we're honest, we want and need the resurrection to be personal. It must be historical. If it's not, our faith is in vain. It must be theological. If it's not, our faith is powerless. It can't be less than those two things, but we desperately want to need it to be more. We want it to be personal. We want the personal presence of Christ with us. And that's what we get in Luke 24. All of the characters get it, but let me just go back to the road to Emmaus to wrap us up. Verse 28. As they approach the village to which they're going, they're almost home. They've been talking with Jesus. He's been explaining the scriptures to them. Jesus pretended like he was going to go farther, but they urged him strongly, stay with us. It's almost night. The day's almost over. And so he went in to stay with them. And he was at the table with them. He took on the role of host. He took the bread. He gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. And they asked each other, oh my gosh, were not our hearts burning within us when he was walking with us and explaining all of the Old Testament to us, when he opened the scriptures up to us? They had history and theology, and none of it came to its fullest sense until they had personal presence. I love that the moment when it clicks is when they're on the road. I mean, when Jesus breaks the bread. And then the scriptures make sense. Right? When you get to the place where your hearts burn within you because he's opened your mind to the scriptures, you've got personal presence. I love that it's when he takes the bread and he breaks it, their eyes are opened, because this is just like or very similar to the meal that they had had a week before, what we call the Last Supper. But because of the resurrection, it's not really the Last Supper, is it? It's the ongoing meal of God's people. It's a meal that helps us remember his death, for sure, but it's also a meal that's about resurrection. It points us forward. It's a foretaste of a feast that we're going to have when Christ returns. This is what the resurrection promises. When we take this meal in a moment, this is the promise that you're partaking in. That Christ will come back. That you will see him face to face. And when you do, all your circumstances will change. No more suffering, no more sorrow, no more sin. You will be changed. Resurrected bodies. You will sit down at a feast with him and laugh and laugh and laugh. And best of all, you'll see him face to face. All of your unfulfilled longings will be satisfied in him. Heaven is not a consolation for things that you've lost in this life. It's a restoration. It's genuine, satisfied longings in the presence of Christ. His presence will be our light and joy. That's the meal that we're about to have together. And when we take the bread and the wine, and the Spirit of God makes real to us the life and the death and the resurrection, when it comes real to our senses, you've got personal presence. And isn't that what you want? Don't you want the history and the theology of the resurrection come flooding into your heart and mind in this meal such that you know you've got Jesus with you. You see him. If that's what you want, then come and eat. Come and drink and be filled with him. He's risen. Let me pray.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.